Daniel chapter 11 is one of the longer chapters in the book of Daniel, about 45 verses, and it's basically one long revelation of a good deal of conflict. If you remember last time in chapter 10, all of chapter 10 was preparatory for chapter 11. Chapter 10 was all of the prior conversation that the angelic messenger had to share with Daniel before he went into the information. Now, I put this handout together in an order, actually. I printed the King James version of the text on the left-hand side, and on the right-hand side, I made notes connected with underlined words in the text, just so you'd have this. Any really good commentary would have all this information probably in it, but there's about 4 pages of that. I'd like for you to go back beyond those 4 pages to this one that says Prophecy of the Horn. There's a good deal of misunderstanding in the theological context of our generation simply because the way Daniel wrote this material leaves room for misunderstanding if you don't keep what he has already said in mind, and if you don't pay attention to what he is actually saying in the words that he's writing. And I'll show you part of what I'm talking about that as we go into some of the stuff that's in chapter 11. We're not going to go through all of the prophecies that are recorded in chapter 11 and try to explain them all, but if you'll notice on the back of the fourth page where the text ends, it says 135 prophetic statements are all now fulfilled. There was a guy named Porphyry. He was a third century philosopher, and he is the first person who actually established the fact that history corresponded closely. This is on the prophecies of Daniel 11, prophetic revelation of Daniel 11, 1-35. Verse 36 through 45 isn't in there because there's no historical correspondence. But he said the correspondence was so precise that he was persuaded that no one could have prophesied these events in the future. And that's been the liberal position from the 3rd century until the 20th century. I've told you several times. At the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, that's when the liberal and Porphyry's claim went down the tube. Because that's the first time we had historical proof that the book of Daniel was written before these prophecies were fulfilled in history. And up until then, all of the naysayers, all of the ones who said, well, you know, there's no prophetic God. In fact, they were denying the God of Daniel. Because Daniel said there's a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. And that was his whole message in a sense. And they said, now, there isn't a God in heaven who reveals this. Whoever wrote this was a pseudo-Daniel. He wrote it in the first century B.C. or sometime after all this stuff had happened. But even they had missed the main point. And that's why I want you to turn to this prophecy of the horns. I want you to remember that in the prophecies that Daniel gave, starting in chapter 2, he started out giving the general progress of human history from Babylon to Messiah's kingdom. We've said this many times in this study too. He just painted in broad brushstrokes that this is going to be this empire and this empire and this empire and then the fourth empire, and then Messiah's kingdom would destroy that fourth one and Messiah's kingdom would fill the earth. The prophecy of chapter 2 was where he gave that real big picture of human history. And the imagery of Messiah's kingdom was the imagery of a stone cut out of a mountain without hands that came rolling across the plain and struck the image that Nebuchadnezzar had dreamed of and pulverized it into dust and blew the dust away. And then that stone swelled up into a great mountain that filled the whole earth. Well, the term mountain is used many, many times in the Old Testament to refer to a kingdom. The mountain of the house of the Lord is a statement out of Isaiah 4, I believe. And it's talking about the kingdom. Well, they use that kind of imagery. But I want you to remember that over in chapter 2, in the prophecy of that time, it says in verse 41, talking about the fourth kingdom, it says, you saw the feet and toes partly of potter's clay and partly of iron. It will be a divided kingdom, but will have in it the toughness of iron as much as you saw the iron mix of common clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of pottery, so some of the kingdom will be strong and part of it will be brittle. And in that you saw the iron mixed with common clay. They will combine with one another in the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another. And what he's talking about there is trying to build a coalition kingdom. Because the toes represent, according to verse 44, in the days of those kings, the toes represent kings. Kings represent kingdoms. So the toes represented 10 kingdoms in alliance with one another. And it says, in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed. And you saw a stone cut out of a mountain without hands, and it crushed the iron, the bronze, and so on. So the dream is true, and the interpretation is trustworthy. So, as early as chapter 2, we were presented with the fact that the fourth empire was going to start off iron, and then it was going to slowly disintegrate until it finally came down to being a combination kingdom where you build an alliance of 10 kingdoms. And part of them will be strong, part of them not. But they won't really adhere to each other because they're partly clay and partly iron. Well, that prophecy doesn't even mention specific individuals per se, except for in the interpretation, King Nebuchadnezzar, you're the head of gold. But that's the only individual that's identified in chapter 2. But when we got to chapter 7, where he reiterated the progress of human history, only this time it wasn't a human image, it was four different kinds of beasts. It started out with a lion, and then it turned into a bear raised up on one side with three ribs sticking in its mouth, and then turned into a leopard that had four heads and wings of a bird on its back. And then a fourth beast that was exceedingly dreadful, according to chapter 7, verse 7. And it's in chapter 7 that we're introduced to this concept of a little horn with a big mouth, the blasphemous mouth that caught Daniel's attention. And in the interpretation of chapter 7's vision, he just fixates on that. He skips those other three kingdoms real quickly. And then he fixates on this fourth kingdom. And it says that Daniel, in verse 16 of chapter 7, wanted to know the exact meaning of all this. And so the general thing in verse 17 was these great beasts, which are four, or four kings that will arise from the earth, but the saints of the highest will receive the kingdom. So you go through four empires, and then the saints inherit the kingdom. That's Messiah's kingdom. So in one verse, you get this interpretation, goes, but it says, I desire to know the exact meaning of the fourth beast, and particularly in verse 20, the horn that had eyes and a mouth uttering great boasts. And he kept looking, and the horn was waging war with the saints and overpowering them. And then the Ancient of Days came and set up his judgment, and he took this fourth beast and cast it into the fiery stream that was ushering out from under the throne of the Ancient of Days. And the whole point there was that he was talking in verse 24 of chapter 7 about the 10 horns, which corresponded to the 10 toes, were going to be 10 kings, and then there would arise another one that was stouter than the original, but he uprooted three in the process of taking over. And then he'll have dominion for a time, times, and half a time, and we went through the chronology of that phrase. But my point in saying this is this. Chapter 7 makes it clear that there is a very interesting, big mouth, boastful, final end time king that caught Daniel's attention. And then in chapter 8, he gets a vision of a ram and a goat and a little horn in the goat kingdom. And he's fixated on that in verses 23 through 26 in chapter 8. And it's another little horn. But this little horn is coming up in the third empire. And so there's this insolent king, and his power is mighty, and he has extraordinary ability to destroy, and he destroys mighty men and holy people, and he causes deceit to succeed, magnifies himself in his heart, opposes the prince of princes. And so what we end up with in chapter 8 is a prophecy of another boastful little horn. And Daniel didn't understand it. Verse 27, chapter 8 says, I didn't understand this. And part of his reason was because there were these prophecies of these two little horns that were acting very much alike, but they were historically separated by empires and time. Because one is in the third empire, and the other one was at the end time of the fourth empire. And it was actually in the fourth empire at the time of this stout little horn of the terrible fourth beast that the beast was actually cast into the fire that was issuing out of the stream underneath the throne of the Ancient of Days, and the saints inherit the kingdom. So Daniel has got this reality that there are two horns. Well, if you'll carry that into chapter 11, it makes a whole lot better sense, because on this prophecies of the horns, we actually have the timeline of the 70 weeks laid out here from March 5th to March the 30th, March 5th, 444 BC to March 30th, 33 AD. That's the 69 weeks. That's the 173,880 days. That's the precision of the prophecy from the time the decree goes forth to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the Messiah, the Prince. There'll be these 69 weeks. So that 173,880 days prophecy is so precise that Jesus came into the on the triumphal entry into Jerusalem in 33 on Sunday and was acclaimed Messiah. And then on Friday he was put to death. So what I want you to understand is that there's two horns, and so when we go into chapter 11, we have to keep in mind that Daniel says about the vision in chapter 11 that when he got it all, he understood. So the confusion's gone that was there at the end of chapter 8. The confusion's gone by the time he gets the vision of chapter 11 explained to him. So we should have the same kind of understanding that he had since he wrote it all down for us. So what I did was I took on this sheet, I have some little arrows. One of them's pointing to texts in Daniel that apply to Antiochus on this side. That's the little horn of the third empire. And texts applying to the Antichrist on this side. That's the little horn of the fourth empire. And so I just summarized the text that addressed those guys. Now, that brings us back to the original information at the first in the front. The issues of the prophecy. It says in verse 1 of chapter 11 that the angelic messenger who had told Daniel that his prayer was heard on the first day began to pray, but the messenger was held up by the angels or the prince of Persia for 21 days, and he was hung up there until Michael showed up and helped him get away. And so he got to Daniel 21 days after he was sent, and that was his explanation for why it was so late getting there, because Daniel had been heard on the first day. So he actually spent 3 weeks prayer and fasting, but the only reason he spent 3 weeks at it is because that's how long it took that angelic messenger to get through the opposition. And it says that he is going to have to go back and fight with the prince of Persia, verse 20 of chapter 10, and then the prince of Greece was going to come. But we talked to you about how long a time frame that is. But it says in verse 1 of chapter 11, this angelic messenger is continuing his information. He says, in the first year, Darius the Mede, I rose to be an encouragement and a protection for him. Now, you know who Darius was. He's the guy that got caught by his own ego and made that edict that you couldn't ask anything of anybody but the king for 30 days, and it trapped Daniel. Daniel had to get thrown in the lion's den by Darius, because the law of the Medes and the Persians says you can make the law, but then you've got to be subject to it. Well, apparently, that's what this angelic messenger is referring to. That the king's dominion in his own kingdom was under serious threat, and he stood up to be an encouragement and protection for Darius. But how did he encourage him and protect him? He probably was in the lion's den, petting those lions and saying, "Now, boys, just cook. You can have breakfast in the morning. You leave this guy alone, you know." I'm speculating. But the fact is, he did say that in verse 1, that he had to be there in the Median period with Darius the Mede in order to keep him from being somehow deposed or whatever. And then in verse 2, he says, "I'm going to tell you the truth. Three more kings are going to rise in Persia, and then a fourth will gain far more riches than all of them. And as soon as he becomes strong, he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece." Now, you remember these names, the Persian, Greece? Alexander the Great didn't come on the scene until 333. We're talking here 535, 534 B.C., 200 years before Greece came on the scene. He's telling him. Verse 20, chapter 10 says, the prince of Greece is going to come. He's about to come. About to come apparently doesn't mean tomorrow. 200 years later. But anyway, he's giving him this short thing. And I've given you some information about the kings, Darius, Cambyses, Pseudo-Smyrna, Darius the First, Astapes and Xerxes the First. That's up there in the notes. Xerxes led the largest army in history against Greece. Hundreds of thousands of officers and men in 480 BC, and he was defeated. So, it says in verse 3, a mighty king will arise, and he'll rule with great authority and do as he pleases. And as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out toward the four points of the compass, though not to his own descendants, nor according to his own authority, which he wielded, for his sovereignty will be uprooted and given to others. Now, verse 4 is the four-headed panther kingdom of Alexander the Great, Greece. It's identified as Greece. And Alexander the Great died suddenly in his early 30s, and his four generals took over. Those four generals I've listed for you on this page, Cassander, Lysimachus, Ptolemy, and Seleucus. Well, Cassander and Lysimachus don't figure into the prophecy anymore, because the issue here is between Ptolemy, who took the Egyptian area, that's where the Ptolemies of Egypt got their connection with Ptolemy. And Ptolemy, I believe, married Cleopatra, who was apparently the daughter of one of the Seleucus kings. So the Ptolemy is the king of the south in chapter 11, and Seleucus is the king of the north and his offspring. That's why I gave you this last sheet that has the Ptolemies and the Seleucids and their overlapping reign. Ptolemy the First and Seleucus the First, they're the ones that started out with Alexander's, two parts of Alexander's four-part kingdom that broke up. And then their lines go down through here. So we just have to keep in mind that the kings of the south and the kings of the north are succeeding kings as they develop in this Grecian Empire. Now, keep that in mind. This is Grecian Empire. This is Alexander the Great's empire that was split by his four generals, and the whole story goes down through. So when you get to verse 5, the king of the south will grow strong. Well, that's Ptolemy. And in verse 6, they'll form an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south will come to the king of the north to carry out a peaceful arrangement, but she will not retain her position. She'll be given up along with those, and so on. All of that's history, and most of it's written in little brief notes on the side. I don't want to spend much time on that, because I really want to get to the issue at the end. That secular philosopher that I mentioned to start with, Porphyry, he recognized that from verses 1 through 35 of chapter 11 had exact historical correspondence. In fact, I've told you this before, but the first time I really worked my way through the book of Daniel, I did it with an encyclopedia. And I just looked up the Ptolemies and the Seleucids and followed the thing. And of course, a good commentary, especially a dispensational one, will have all of this historical stuff in it. John Walbert is a commentary that I used and quoted in some of these notes. So he recognized that there was this correspondence between prophecy and history down to verse 35. But in verse 36, we have a major problem in terms of the way it's going to develop. Because in verse 36, it says, we have this record in verse 29 of chapter 11, the appointed time he'll return and come to the south, but this last time will not turn out the way it did, for the ships of Kittim will come against him, verse 30. Kittim is the word for Rome. So this was the first time that he butted heads with Rome. And this is Antiochus Epiphanes. And there was a general, a Roman general, who met him and said, you're going to have to turn around and go back. We're not going to allow you to invade Egypt again. And Antiochus said, well, I need to think about that. As the story goes, that Roman soldier pulled his sword out of his sheath and he inscribed a circle around Antiochus and he said, you think about all you want, but before you step out of the circle, you tell me your answer. So he had to tell him right then whether he was going to bow to Rome's power or not. And he apparently felt like he could not beat Rome. So he went back through the Holy Land and he was angry. He was like a wasp that had been swatted. And he was mad, and he took it out on the Jews. And that's when he desecrated their temple and killed the pig and poured the blood all over the altar and all of that. That's what it says in verse 31. He desecrates the sanctuary fortress, and he does away with the regular sacrifice, and they set up the abomination of desolation. Now remember, this is the third kingdom. This is the little horn of the third kingdom. This is Antiochus Epiphanes. The word Epiphanes means the manifest God. Antiochus considered himself God in the flesh. His enemies called him Epimenes, which meant crazy. Antiochus, the insane man. So anyway, when you read verses 29 through 35, you have this Antiochus Epiphanes' historical narrative. And then it says in verse 36, then the king will do as he pleases, and he will exalt and magnify himself above every god and speak monstrous things against the God of gods, and he will prosper until the indignation is finished, for that which is decreed will be done. Now, in verse 36, before we go any further, you can hear some echoes of chapter 7. Because he is magnifying himself above every god, speaking monstrous things against the God of gods, and the indignation is going to be finished. So the stone is going to destroy the image, pulverize it into dust, and swell into a mountain that covers the whole earth. The indignation is finished. So verse 36, based on the preceding prophecies, is telling you that there's a shift here in who Daniel's talking about. He just calls him the king. But it says in verse 37, he'll show no regard for the gods of his fathers or for the desire of women, nor will he show any regard for any other god, for he will magnify himself above them all. He will honor a god of fortresses, a god his fathers did not know. He'll honor him with gold, silver, costly stones, and treasures, and he'll take action against the strongest of fortresses with the help of a foreign god. And it says in verse 40, at the time of the end, the king of the south will collide with him, and the king of the north will storm against him. So verse 36, the person in verse 36 that goes down through the end of this chapter is not a king of the north, nor is he a king of the south. So we have moved. What Daniel did was he took us in the third kingdom, he took us up to the prophecies concerning Antiochus Epiphanes, which was the little horn of the third empire. And he talks about him establishing the abomination of desolation in the temple sanctuary. And then he just jumps clear to the end of the Fourth Empire. He jumps from the shadow, in a very real sense, the little horn of the Third Kingdom is the foreshadowing of the little horn of the Fourth. This is the first go-around. And he sacrifices a sow on the altar and desecrates the temple. But in chapter 7, Daniel was absolutely mesmerized by the blasphemous stuff coming out of the mouth of the Fourth Empire horn. So what he did is he jumped. In verse 35, he's talking about this guy, and then all of a sudden, he's jumped clear across history, and as it turns out, several thousand years. And this is why there's confusion in terms of understanding, because if you don't keep in mind that Daniel had these two horns he wanted us to be focused on, one foreshadowing the final one. But he has these little phrases like, the indignation is finished. It's the time of the end. Now, in the second letter that Paul wrote to the Thessalonians in the New Testament, he tells us about this little horn of the Fourth Kingdom by referring to this man of sin that's going to arise, and he will set himself on the throne in the temple of God in Jerusalem and proclaim himself to be God and demand that everybody worship him. That's Antichrist. That's the little horn of the Fourth Kingdom. So the first little horn desecrated the altar by pouring the blood of a pig on it. The second one brings about the abomination of desolation, which is a human being sitting himself up in the temple of the God of heaven and saying, I'm the God of heaven. That's the ultimate blasphemy. So when we get to verses 36 through 45, we're actually talking about the little horn of the Fourth Kingdom. And if we understand that like it's presented by Daniel, where his focus is not on chronological continuity, his focus is on thematic continuity, where he builds up to this little horn and its opposition against the God of heaven, and then he jumps to the next little horn and he develops it till the time of the end, and then and the indignation is finished. And we're going to get into that more in chapter 12. But let's look at some of the things that it says about him. In verse 36, he's going to magnify himself above every god. He's going to declare himself to be God. The book of the Revelation fills in some of the details, because one of the ways he's going to declare himself to be above every god is that during the first half of the 70th week, Elijah and Enoch are going to be the two witnesses that reappear on the earth. And they're going to have a very vocal prophetic ministry in the streets of Jerusalem for 3.5 years. And the book tells us that if anybody tries to harm them, fire comes out of the mouth and destroys them. So it doesn't matter if it's a sniper from 500 yards away or what. If anybody tries to harm them, they die at the mouth of these two witnesses, these two prophets. But the Antichrist is going to come to Jerusalem at the end of that 3.5 years, and he's going to confront these two prophets on the streets of Jerusalem, and he's going to be successful in killing them. Well, they're going to have been prophesying in the name of Yahweh, God of Israel, for 3.5 years. It hadn't rained on the earth for 3.5 years. Whatever plague they called for came, just like Moses in Egypt. And yet, when it comes to head-to-head, he kills them. And he leaves their bodies lying in the street in Jerusalem for 3.5 days. And then it says the whole world will see them rise up from the streets and ascend into heaven. You can see the TV cameras on 6 o'clock news. They're focused on these dead bodies, and all of a sudden, whoop, they go. It's just, those are the facts. That's what the Bible says is going to happen. But in that process, apparently he's going to receive a mortal wound to the neck or head. It's a mortal wound, kills him. But he is resurrected semi-immediately after that. And then everybody says, well, he's got to be God. Nobody could do this but God. He's got to be greater than all of these other gods, because he's just defeated the God who's been defending Israel all this time, and and he's taken his seat in his temple and proclaimed himself to be God. And when he was wounded to death, he was revived, resurrected, however you want to describe it, because we're not given a real time frame for how long he might have lain mortally wounded before he got back up. But the interesting thing about it is, in the book of Revelation, it is at that exact point, 3.5 years into it, that Satan is cast out of heaven. And in my mind, I can picture him falling straight out of heaven right into the body of that mortally wounded Antichrist and taking over his body. Now we have a devil-possessed human body. The guy may have actually been brain dead, and his brain may still be dead, but Satan wants a body. Now he's got one. The next 3.5 years is going to be total disaster for Israel. But at the end, Jesus comes back, the stone cut out of the mountain without hands, and the beast is thrown into the fiery lake, and the beast and the Antichrist are thrown alive into the lake of fire. So they're not even killed. They're just... So these are the things that we're told as a prelude in verse 36 of Daniel to prophecies made in 2 Thessalonians and in the book of Revelation. But it says that he will honor a god of fortresses, verse 38, a god whom his fathers didn't know, and he'll honor him with gold, silver, costly stones, and treasures. And he will take action against the strongest of fortresses with this foreign god, and he'll give great honor to those who acknowledge him, and he'll cause them to rule over dominion, and will parcel out land for a price. In other words, you be loyal to me, I'll make you rich and wealthy and all that. But the point is, this honoring this god with gold, silver, and costly stones and treasures, that's his military budget. It's his military budget. That's what he's honoring. A god of fortresses, and he's going to be using weapons that are enormously powerful. He can take on the strongest of fortresses. His whole issue here is, I got bigger and better nukes than you got. He's going to have the most powerful military the world has ever known. Right now, we're sitting in that seat. But anyway, at the time of the end, now here we're close to the stone coming out of the mountain and pulverizing this guy. At the time of the end, the king of the south, which would be the ruler of Egypt, and the king of the north, which would be the ruler of Syria, will storm against him with chariots and horsemen and many ships, and he'll enter countries and overflow them and pass through, and he'll enter the beautiful land. Russia is going to descend on Israel, and be 4/5 of Russia's entire military complex will be destroyed by a massive earthquake, and that'll create such a huge power vacuum. There'll be no Russia anymore. The land will be there, and the people will be there, but it will be absolutely nothing anymore militarily. And we're told in the book of the Revelation that 200 million men will come from the east to march against the Antichrist. Well, 200 million from the east could be China and Japan and Korea and maybe even India. It could be a combination of those nations marching against the Antichrist. The scenario in Revelation is that they all come together in the Valley of Megiddo. It's called Armageddon. And the blood is going to run as deep in places as the bridles of horses, which implies something. How fast does blood coagulate whenever it runs out of a body? Pretty fast, unless there's some kind of maybe nuclear consequence that causes it not to coagulate so fast. Either that, or there are going to be so many people killed all at the same time that the blood will just run from millions of men suddenly. This is God in action. That's what Armageddon is. I read in the Old Testament about how Sennacherib challenged Hezekiah, and the next morning there were 900,000, I believe is the number, of dead soldiers from Assyria. They all died in that one night. Well, if they died in a bloodletting, there'd been some blood running from 900,000 men. That'd be a lot of blood. Anyway, time of the end, you have the king of the north and the king of the south, so this guy's neither one of those. And they storm against him. And he enters into the beautiful land, and many countries fall, but these will be rescued out of his hand. Edom, Moab, and the foremost of the sons of Ammon. On your notes in the back, let's see. I don't have those on here. I stopped at verse 35. Sorry about that. Ammon is the modern-day Jordan. So somehow, right in the middle of it all, Jordan's going to escape him. And Moab was on the east side of Jordan. And I think Ammon was too. Anyway, the land of Egypt will not escape. And he will gain control of the hidden treasures of gold and silver and all the precious things of Egypt and Libya, and the Ethiopians will follow at his heels. So we're talking here about some kind of wealth that is going to be discovered in Egypt that he's going to get control of. And then it says in verse 44, but rumors from the east, that'd be that 200 million man army, and from the north will disturb him, and he'll go forth with great wrath to destroy and annihilate many, and he'll pitch his tents of his royal pavilion between the seas and the beautiful holy mountain. Yet he will come to his end, and no one will help him. His end is Revelation 19. The sign of the Son of Man appears in heaven, and all of a sudden here comes Jesus and all these tens of thousands of the host of heaven with him. And all of the armies of the earth begin to train their weapons of destruction on this one that's coming out of the heavens. They're going to be claiming it's an alien invasion. But it isn't going to help them turn all those weapons toward him because the sword of his mouth. The only two he will not kill is the beast and the false prophet. The rest of them are all dead. Jesus said to Nicodemus, if you're not born again, you will not see or enter the kingdom. Which means that before Messiah sets up his kingdom, every last unbeliever on the planet will be dead. Only believers are going to be left to go into Messiah's kingdom. And when you look at the numbers, 3/4 of the population of earth will die in that, basically in the last 3.5 years of the 70th week of Daniel. 3/4 of 8 billion is 6 billion people. You couldn't have enough funerals every day to bury them all. So that's the prophecy of the demise, basically, of the little horn of the fourth kingdom. But you have to have this understanding that Daniel was fixated on these two little horns in order for chapter 11 to come together like it's supposed to. The text says the king will do what his will is, but he's not the king of the north or the king of the south. And those are the two kings that they've been talking about all the way through chapter 11 until you get to verse 36. And then all of a sudden, he's neither one of those. And that suddenness is simply Daniel saying, okay, I've been giving you these broad brushstrokes of human history, but now I've pulled you up to the character of human rebellion as manifest in Antiochus Epiphanes. And then he jumps from that picture to the picture of the final blasphemy, where it isn't Antiochus Epiphanes, it's a man who's he's devil-possessed. He's possessed by Satan. And he sets up a throne in the temple of God and proclaims himself as God. That's the final blasphemy. And then it's over.